Barry found the key that fitted the top one easily enough. The second, however, was taking more time. Michaela thought Lila might have kept that key for herself. It might be in her pocket, buried under one of those white cocoons. "Do you see anyone coming?" she called to Garth. "Not yet, but hurry up. This is making me need to pee." There were only three keys left on the ring when Barry found the one that turned the second lock. He opened the door, and Michaela saw a small closet-sized room with rifles stowed in racks and pistols nestled in styrofoam-lined cubbies. There were shelves stacked with boxes of ammunition. On one wall was a poster showing a Texas Ranger in a 10-gallon hat, pointing a revolver with a huge black barrel. "I fought the law, and the law won," read the line beneath. "Get as much of the ammo as you can," Barry said. "I'll get the M4s and some of the Glocks." Michaela started for the ammo shelves, then changed her mind and went back into the dispatch area. She grabbed Lenny's wastebasket and turned it over, dumping out a heap of crumpled paper and takeout coffee cups. Lenny took no notice. Michaela loaded as many boxes of ammunition as she thought she could carry into the wastebasket and left the secure room with the basket clasped in her arms. Garth brushed past her to get his own armload of weaponry. Barry had left one of the triple entry doors open. Michaela staggered down the wide stone steps through the thickening rain in time to see Barry reach the Fleetwood. The bearded man got up from his bench, still holding his umbrella over his head. He said something to Barry, who replied. Then the bearded man, Willie, opened the RV's rear door so Barry could put in his armload of guns. Michaela joined him, panting. Barry took the wastebasket from her and dumped the boxes of ammo on top of the jackstraw pile of guns. They went back together while Willie stood beneath his umbrella, watching. Garth came out with a second load of armament, his pants sagging under the weight of the ammo boxes he had shoved into all his pockets.
"What did the old guy say to you?" Michaela asked.
"He wanted to know if we were doing something Sheriff Norcross would approve of," Barry replied. "I said we were." They went back inside and hurried to the secure room. They had taken about half the weaponry. Michaela spotted something that looked like a submachine gun afflicted with the mumps.
"We should definitely take that. I think it's the tear gas launcher thingy. I don't know if we need it, but I don't want anyone else to have it."
Garth rejoined them.
"I come bearing bad news, Counselor Holden. Truck with a jackpot light on the dash just pulled up behind your RV.
They hurried to the doors and peered out through the smoked glass. Two men were getting out of the truck, and Michaela recognized them both. The clown and his autograph hound partner.
"Oh, Christ," Barry said. "That's Don Peters from the prison. What's he doing pretending to be a cop? The man has the brains of an insect."
"That particular insect was most recently seen manning a roadblock near the prison," Garth said. "Same bug, same truck."
The bearded man approached the newcomers, said something, and pointed further up Main Street. Peters and his young partner ran to their truck and jumped in. The light bars came on, and they pulled out with the siren screaming.
"What's going on?" Lenny asked in a distracted voice. "Just what in the doodly-fuck is going on?"
"Everything's fine," Garth said and gave her a smile. "Not to worry."
Then to Barry and Michaela,
"May I suggest we quit while we're ahead?"
"What's going on?" Lenny wailed. "Oh, this is all just a bad dream."
"Hang in there, miss," Garth said. "It might get better."
The three of them left, running once they got to the concrete path. Michaela had the grenade launcher in one hand and a bag of tear gas shells in the other. She felt like Bonnie Parker. Willie was standing beside the Fleetwood.
"How did you get those guys out of here?" Barry asked.
"Told them someone was shooting up the hardware store. They won't be long, so I think you folks better roll."
Willie snapped his umbrella closed.
"And I think I better roll with you. Those two ain't gonna be happy campers when they come back."
"Why would you help us like this?" Garth asked.
"Well, it's strange days now, and a man has got to trust his instincts. Mine have always been pretty good. Barry here's always been a friend to Lila, even though he bats for the other team in court, and I recognize this girl here from the TV news."
He peered at Garth.
"You I don't like the looks of so much. But you're with them, so what the hell? Besides, the die is cast, as they say. Where are we going?
First to pick up Lila's son, Barry said, then up to the prison. How would you like to take part in a siege, Willie? Because that may be what's shaping up. Willie smiled, showing tobacco-stained teeth.
Well, I had a coonskin cap when I was a kid, and I always liked movies about the Alamo, so why not? Help me up the steps of this rig, would you? The goddamn rain plays hell with my rheumatism.
6. Jared, waiting at the door of the demo house, was getting ready to call his father again when a huge RV pulled up in front. Jared recognized the driver. Like his mother's deputies and many other town officials, Barry Holden had been a dinner guest at the Norcross house on occasion. Jared met him on the stoop.
Come on, Barry said. We have to go.
Jared hesitated. My mom and three others are in the attic. It was really hot up there before the rain started, and it will be hot again tomorrow. You should help me get them down.
It will cool off fast tonight, Jared, and we have no time.
Barry didn't know if the cocooned women could feel heat or cold, but he did know that their window of opportunity was rapidly closing. He also thought that Lila and the others might be better off stashed away here on this quiet street. He had insisted on bringing his own wife and daughters along because of the RV. It was well known in dueling, and he was afraid of reprisals.
Can we at least tell someone?
That's a decision your father can make.
Please, Jared. Jared allowed himself to be led down the walk to the idling Fleetwood. The back door opened, and his old Pop Warner coach leaned out. Jared smiled in spite of himself.
Coach Burke!
Well, look at this, Willie exclaimed. The only pee-wee quarterback I ever had who didn't drop every other snap. Climb in here, son.
But the first thing Jared saw was the array of guns and ammo on the floor.
Holy shit, what are these for?
A woman sat on the plaid couch just inside the door. She was young, extremely pretty, and vaguely familiar, but the most remarkable thing about her was how awake she looked. She said, "Hopefully just insurance." A man standing in the passage in front of her laughed.
"I wouldn't bet on that, Mickey."
He held out his hand. "Garth Flickinger." Behind Garth Flickinger, on a matching couch, were arranged four cocooned bodies, each smaller than the previous, like a set of separated nesting dolls.
"That's Mr. Holden's wife and daughters, I'm told," Coach Burke said.
The RV started rolling. Jared staggered. Willie Burke steadied him, and as Jared shook with Mr. Flickinger, he thought that maybe all of this was a dream. Even the guy's name seemed like something out of a dream. Who in the real world was named Garth Flickinger?
"Pleased to meet you," he said.
In his peripheral vision, the Holden women rolled against one another as the RV went around a corner. Jared told himself not to see them, but there was no not seeing them, reduced to mummified dolls.
I'm Jared Norcross.
And dream or no dream, he had a certain resentment. There had been time for Mr. Holden to get his family, hadn't there? And why was that? Because it was his RV? Jared's phone rang as Barry hooked them around the Tremaine Street cul-de-sac. They were leaving his mother, Molly, Mary, and Mrs. Ransom behind. It felt wrong. Everything felt wrong, though, so what else was new? The caller was his father. They spoke briefly, and then Clint asked to speak to Michaela. When she took the phone, Clint said, "Here's what you need to do." She listened.
7. Deputy Sheriff Reed Barrows had parked Unit 3 directly across the byroad leading to the prison. This was high ground. He and Vern had a clear view down at least 6 miles of Route 31. Reed had expected a ration of shit from Peters about being relieved so soon after they had taken up their post, but Peters had been surprisingly agreeable, probably eager to get an early start on the day's drinking. Maybe the kid was, too. Reed doubted if they were checking IDs at the squeaky wheel this week,
and currently the cops had better things to do than enforce alcohol laws. Peters reported they had stopped just a single car, some reporter who'd gone up to the prison hoping to get an interview and been turned away. Reed and Vern had stopped no one at all. Even traffic on the main road was so sparse it was nearly non-existent. The town was in mourning for its women, Reed thought. Hell, the world was in mourning. Reed turned to his partner, who was reading something on his Kindle and picking his nose. You're not wiping boogers under the seat, are you? Jesus, no. Don't be disgusting. Vern raised his rump, pulled a handkerchief from his back pocket, wiped a little green treasure into it, and replaced it. Tell me something. What exactly are we doing here? Do they really think Norcross is stupid enough to take that woman out into the world when he's got her behind bars right now? I don't know. If a food truck or something comes along, what are we supposed to do? Stop it and radio for instructions. Radio who? Terry or Frank? About this, Reed was less sure. Guess I'd try Terry's cell first thing. Leave a message just to cover our asses if he doesn't pick up. Why don't we worry about that if it happens? Which it probably won't, the mess everything's in. Yeah, infrastructure's shot to hell. What's infrastructure? Look it up on your Kindle, why don't you? Vern did so. The basic physical and organizational structures needed for the operation of a society or an enterprise. Huh. Huh? What does huh mean? That you're right. It's shot to hell. I went to the Shopwell this morning before I came on. Place looks like a bomb hit it. Down the hill, in the gray afternoon light, they could see an approaching vehicle. Reed? What? With no women, there's going to be no babies. You've got a scientific mind, all right, Reed said. If this doesn't end, where will the human race be in another 60 or 100 years? This was something Reed Barrows did not want to think about, especially with his wife in a cocoon and his toddler being babysat, probably inadequately, by ancient Mr. Freeman next door. Nor did he have to. The vehicle was now close enough to see it was a humongous zebra-striped camper and slowing down as if it meant to turn onto the prison road. Not that it could, with three parked across it. That RV belongs to Holden, said Vern. The lawyer. My brother services it over a Maylock. The Fleetwood came to a stop. The driver's door opened, and Barry Holden got out. At the same time, the officers got out of three. Holden greeted them with a smile. Gentlemen, I come bearing good tidings of great joy. Neither Reed nor Vern returned the smile. No one goes up to the prison, Mr. Holden, Reed said. Sheriff's orders. Now, I don't think that's strictly true, Barry said, still smiling. I believe a gentleman named Frank Geary gave that order, and he's what you might call self-appointed. Isn't that so? Reed wasn't sure how to respond to this, so he kept silent. In any case, Barry said, I got a call from Clint Norcross. He's decided that turning the woman over to local law enforcement is the right thing to do. Well, thank God for that, Vern exclaimed. The man sees reason. He wants me at the prison to facilitate the deal and make it clear for the public record as to why he went outside of protocol. Just a formality, really. Reed was about to say, you couldn't find a smaller vehicle to come up here in? Car wouldn't start, maybe? But that was when Three's dash radio blared. It was Terry Coombs, and he sounded upset. Unit Three, respond! Right now! Right now! 8. Just as Reed and Vern were first noticing the approach of Barry Holden's RV, Terry Coombs entered the Olympia Diner and walked to the booth where Frank and Deputy Pete Ordway were sitting. Frank was less than happy to see Coombs up and about, but concealed his displeasure as best he could. Yo, Terry. Terry nodded to both men. He had shaved and changed his shirt. He looked rocky but sober. Jack Albertson told me you guys were here. Albertson was one of the retired deputies who had been pressed back into service 2 days before. I got some pretty bad news from Bridger County 15 minutes ago. There was no smell of booze about Terry. Frank hoped to change that. He didn't like encouraging a man who was probably an incipient alcoholic, but Coombs was easier to work with when he'd had a few. "What's going on in Bridger?" Pete asked. "Wreck on the highway. Judge Silver went into Doors Hollow Stream. He's dead."
"What?"
Frank's shout was loud enough to bring Gus Vereen out of the kitchen. "It's a damn shame," Terry said. "He was a fine man." He pulled up a chair. "Any idea what he was doing over there?" "Went to speak to an ex-FBI guy he knew in Coughlin about helping to talk sense into Norcross," Frank said. "It had to have been a heart attack. The judge had looked horrible, washed out and shaky." "If he's dead, I guess that's out." With an effort, he composed himself. He'd liked Judge Silver, and had been willing to go along with him up to a certain point. That point was erased now. "And that woman is still at the prison." Frank leaned forward. "Awake. Norcross was lying about her being in a cocoon. Hicks told me." "Hicks has got a poor reputation," Terry said. Frank wasn't hearing it. "And there's other strange things about her. She's the key." "If the bitch started it, she'll know how to stop it," Pete said. Terry's mouth twitched. "There's no proof of that, Pete. And since Aurora started halfway around the world, it seems kind of far-fetched. I think we all need to take a deep breath and just..." Frank's walkie came to life. It was Don Peters. "Frank, Frank, come in. I need to talk to you. You better answer this thing because they fucking..." Frank raised the walkie to his lips. "This is Frank. Come back and watch the profanity. You're going out over the... They fucking robbed the guns," Don yelled. "Some decrepit old piece of shit sent us on a wild goose chase, and then they robbed the fucking guns right out of the fucking sheriff's station." Before Frank could reply, Terry snatched the walkie-talkie out of his hand. "Coombs here. Who did?" "Barry Holden, in a big mother humper of an RV. Your dispatcher said there were others with him, but she's three-quarters out of it and don't know who."
"All the guns?" Terry asked, astounded. "They took all the guns?"
"No, no, not all. I guess they didn't have time, but plenty of them. Jesus Christ, that RV was huge!"
Terry stared at the walkie in his hand, frozen. Frank told himself he ought to keep his mouth shut and let Terry work through the computation on his own, and he just couldn't do it. It seemed he never could once he was angry.
"Do you still think we just need to take a deep breath and wait Norcross out? Because you know where they're going with those weapons, don't you?"
Terry looked up at him, his lips pressed so tightly together his mouth was almost gone.
"I think you might have forgotten who's in charge here, Frank." "Sorry, Sheriff."
Under the table, his hands were so tightly clenched they were shaking, the nails digging crescents into his palms. Terry was still staring at him.
"Tell me you put someone out there on the road to the prison."
"It would be your own damn fault if I didn't, drunk as you were."
"Ah, but who had been plying him with the booze?"
"I did. Wrangle and Barrows."
"Good. That's good. Which unit are they in?" Frank didn't know, but Pete Ordway did.
"3.
Don was blabbering on, but Terry cut him off and pressed send.
Unit 3, respond. Right now. Right now."
Chapter 8. 1. At the squawk of the radio, Reed Barrows told Barry to stay put.
"No problem," Barry said.
He gave the side of the Fleetwood 3 knocks, a message to Willie Burke, crouched behind the curtain that separated the front of the RV from the back, that it was on to Plan B. Plan B was pretty simple. Beat it while Barry provided as much of a distraction as possible. It was paramount that the guns got to the prison and that his girls were safe from harm. Barry didn't have to think twice about it. They'd arrest him, of course, but he knew a terrific lawyer. He placed a hand on Vern Rangel's shoulder, gently easing him past the front of the RV.
Sounds like someone at the station's got a full diaper,
Rangel observed cheerfully, moving thoughtlessly along with the lawyer's guidance.
Where are we going?
Where they were going was away from the RV, so that one, Rangel didn't see Willie Burke sliding into the driver's seat, and two, to give the Fleetwood room to go forward without running anyone over. Barry couldn't tell the officer that, though. A concept that he had endeavored to impress upon his girls was that the law was impersonal. It wasn't about your feelings, it was about your argument. If you could partition yourself off from personal preference entirely, that was for the best. You wanted, really, to remove your skin and assume the skin of your client, while at the same time hanging on to your brain. Gerda, who had been asked on a date by a high school boy, just a sophomore but still much too old for her, had recently tried to get her father to take her on as a pro bono client to argue to her mother that she was old enough to go to the movies with the guy. This had been exceptionally clever of Gerda, but Barry had recused himself on the grounds of their familial relationship. Also because, as her father, he had no intention of letting her go anywhere with a boy who was almost 15 and probably got hard every time the wind blew. If Carrie Benson wanted to spend time with her that badly, he'd said, then Carrie could buy her an ice cream sundae at the Dairy Treat right here in town. And in broad daylight. What Barry had chosen not to express to Gerda was the sticky provision of the utterly culpable. Sometimes you pulled on your client's skin only to find that they, you, were astoundingly, hopelessly, no way to even pretend, guilty as original sin. When this situation arose, the only sensible tactic was to distract and disrupt, litigate minutia, gum up the wheels, and delay. With luck, you might wear the opposition down until they offered you an advantageous deal just to be rid of you, or better yet, irritate or flummox them into screwing up their case altogether. With that in mind, he improvised with the most dumbfounding question he could come up with on short notice. Listen, Vern, wanted to take you aside and ask you something.
Okay.
Barry leaned forward confidentially.
Are you circumcised?
Rain sprinkles dotted the surface of Vern Rangel's glasses, obscuring his eyes. Barry heard the engine of the RV turn over, heard the clunk as Willie put it into drive, but the cop paid no mind. The circumcision question had put him in mental vapor lock.
Gee, Mr. Holden.
Vern absently shook out a handkerchief and began to refold it.
Kind of personal, you know.
Behind them there was a thud and the whinge of metal grinding against metal. Meanwhile, Reed Barrows had scooted into the driver's side of the cruiser to take Terry's call, but the mic slipped out of his damp hand. The seconds that elapsed while he bent to retrieve it from the footwell and untangle the cord were important because that got Willie Burke settled in driving mode.
Roger, this is Unit 3. Barrows speaking. Over, Reed said once he had the mic again.
Out the window, he saw the RV swerving around the front of the cruiser to the gravel shoulder and grassy embankment on the southbound half of the road. This vision didn't alarm Reed. It perplexed him. Why was Barry Holden moving his RV? Or was Vern moving it so someone else could get by? That didn't make sense. They needed to sort out the shyster and his Fleetwood before they dealt with anyone else who wanted to drive through. Terry Coombs's voice blared over the radio.
Arrest Barry Holden and confiscate his vehicle. He's got a pile of stolen guns and he's headed for the prison. You hear me?
The front end of the RV bumped the front end of the cruiser. The mic jumped out of Reed's hand a second time, and his view through the windshield swung away as if on hinges.
Hey!
2. In the back of the RV, Jared lost his balance. He fell off the couch and onto the guns.
You okay? Garth asked.
The doctor had kept his feet by pressing his back against the counter of the kitchenette and grabbing the sink.
Yeah. Thanks for asking about me.
Michaela had managed to stay on the couch, but she'd fallen over onto her side.
Garth realized that he adored Mickey. She had sand, as the old-timers like to say. He wouldn't change a thing about her. Her nose and everything else was as close to flawless as you could get.
"I didn't have to, Mickey," he replied. "I know you're okay because you'll always be okay."
3. The RV rolled slowly along, hugging the sloping roadside at a tilted angle and doing about 15 miles an hour, shoving the cruiser aside. Metal squalled against metal. Vern gaped and spun to Barry. The lawyer had pissed right down his leg. Vern therefore slugged Barry in the eye and dumped him flat on his rear end.
"Stop the RV!" bellowed Reed from the open door of the shifting cruiser. "Shoot the tires!"
Vern drew his service weapon. The RV broke loose from the cruiser and began to pick up speed. It was at a 2 o'clock angle as it moved off the shoulder, now headed back for the center of the road. Vern, aiming for the right rear tire, triggered too quickly. His shot went way high, puncturing a piece of the RV's wall. The vehicle was about 50 yards distant. Once it gained the road, it would be gone. Vern took a moment to reset and aimed again, properly, focusing again on the rear right tire, and fired into the air as Barry Holden tackled him to the ground. 4. Jared, on the floor, his back poked in half a dozen places by gun sights and gun barrels, was deafened by the blast. He could somehow feel the screaming around him. The woman, Michaela? Flickinger? But he couldn't hear it. His eyes found a hole in the wall. The bullet had made an opening like a burst firecracker top. His hands, flat on the floor of the RV, felt the wheels moving below, gaining speed, thrumming on the hardtop. Flickinger still had his feet. He was braced at the kitchen counter. Nope, it wasn't Flickinger who was screaming. Jared looked where the doctor was looking. The cocooned figures lay on the couch. A bloody cavity had opened at the sternum of the third in the row, the oldest of the three girls, Gerda. She stood up from the couch and staggered forward. She was the one that was screaming. Jared saw that she was moving at Michaela, who was huddled at the end of the parallel couch. The girl's arms were raised, torn loose from the webbing that had held them fast to her torso, and the impression of the open, howling mouth under the material was vivid. Moths spilled from the hole in her sternum. Flickinger caught Gerda. She spun, and her hands clawed at his throat as they wobbled in a circle and went tripping over the guns on the floor. The two bodies crashed against the rear door. The latch snapped, the door flew open, and they fell out, followed by a rush of moths and a stream of guns and bullets. 5. Evie moaned.
"What?" Angel asked. "What's wrong?"
"Oh," Evie said. "Nothing."
"Liar," Jeanette said. She was still slumped in the shower alcove. Angel had to hand it to Jeanette. She was almost as stubborn as Angel herself.
"That's the sound you make when people die."
Jeanette inhaled. She cocked her head and addressed an invisible person.
"That's the sound she makes when people die, Damien."
"I guess that's true, Jeanette," Evie said. "I guess I do that."
"That's what I said. Didn't I, Damien?"
"You're seeing shit, Jeanette," Angel said.
Jeanette's gaze stayed on the empty air.
"Moths came from her mouth, Angel. She's got moths in her. Now let me alone. I'm trying to have a conversation with my husband."
Evie excused herself. "I need to make a call." 6. Reed heard Vern's shot as he hurled himself over the police cruiser's console and jerked open the passenger door. He glimpsed the rear end of the RV as it lumbered over beyond the slope, its back door flapping back and forth. Two bodies lay in the road. Reed unholstered his service weapon and ran toward them. Past the bodies, there was a trail of 3 or 4 assault rifles and a few handfuls of ammunition scattered among them. When he reached the bodies, he stopped.
Blood and gray matter painted the pavement around the skull of the prone man who was nearest. Reed had seen his share of corpses, but the mess here was notable, maybe a prize winner. In the course of his fall, the guy's glasses had flipped up to rest on the fringe of his curly hair. The arrangement of the glasses gave him a perversely warm and casual look, a teacherly aspect, as he lay dead in the road with his brains splattered on the asphalt. A few steps further on, a female was sprawled on her side in the position that Reed himself often adopted when he was on the couch watching television. Her mask of webbing had been scraped away by contact with the road, and the skin that remained was tattered. From what was left of the face and of her body, Reed could determine that she was young, but not much more than that. A bullet had torn a large wound in her chest. The girl's blood flowed onto the damp pavement. Sneakers slapped against the pavement behind Reed.
"Gerda!"
someone screamed.
"Gerda!"
Reed turned and Barry Holden rushed past him, falling to his knees by the body of his daughter. Vern Rangel, nose bloodied, staggered up the road after Holden, bellowing that he'd circumcise him, the fucker. What a hill of shit. A smeared guy, a dead girl, a howling attorney, Vern Rangel with his blood up, guns and ammo in the road. Reed was relieved that Lila Norcross was not currently serving as chief, because he would not have wanted to even begin to attempt to explain to her how it had happened. Reed grabbed for Vern a second too late, catching just a piece of fabric at his shoulder. Vern shook him off and swatted the butt end of his pistol across the back of Barry Holden's head. There was an ugly cracking noise, like a breaking branch, and a gout of blood. Barry Holden tumbled face first onto the ground beside his daughter. Vern squatted beside the unconscious lawyer and began to hit him again and again with the butt of his gun.
"Fuck you! Fuck you! Fuck you! You broke my nose! You—"
The young woman, who should have been dead and wasn't, grasped Vern's jaw, wrapped her fingers over his lower teeth, and jerked him down to her level. Her head lifted and her mouth snapped wide, and she buried her teeth in Vern's throat. Reed's partner began to whack at her with the pistol butt. It didn't faze her. Arterial blood pumped out around her lips. Reed remembered his own weapon. He raised it and shot. The bullet entered through the young woman's eye, and her body went loose, but her mouth remained locked on Vern's throat. She appeared to be drinking his blood. On his knees, Reed dug his fingers into the hot and slippery mess where the young woman's teeth were clamped to his partner's throat. He hauled and pulled, feeling tongue and enamel. Vern swung at her once more, ineffectually, his gun flying from his relaxing hand and bouncing away. Then he collapsed. 7. Last in a 3-cruiser caravan, Frank drove alone. Everyone had their sirens going. Ordway and Terry were at the fore, followed by Peters and Peters' sidekick, Blass. Aloneness was not something that Frank sought, but it seemed to find him. Why was that? Elaine had taken Nana and left him alone. Oscar Silver had gone off the road and left him alone. It was grim. It had made him grim. Maybe that was how it had to be, though, how he had to be, to do what he had to do. But could he do what he had to do? Things were going wrong. Reed Barrows had radioed that shots had been fired and there was an officer down. Frank believed he was ready to kill for his daughter. He was certain that he was ready to die for her. What occurred to him now, though, was that he was not the only one who was willing to take mortal risks. Norcross's people had stolen police armaments and broken through a barricade. Whatever their reasons, they were determined. It worried Frank that they should be so determined, that their reasons should be such an enigma. What was driving them? What was it between Eve Black and Norcross? His cell phone rang. The caravan was speeding north on Balls Hill. Frank pulled the phone from his pocket. "Geary."
"Frank, this is Eve Black."
She spoke a shade above a whisper, and her voice had a husky, flirty quality.
It is it? Nice to meet you.
I'm calling you from my new cell phone. I didn't have one, so Lore Hicks gifted me his. Wasn't that chivalrous of him? By the way, you might as well slow down. No need to risk an accident. The RV got away. There's just 4 dead people and Reed Barrows.
How do you know that?
Trust me, I know. Clint was surprised it was so easy to pull off the heist. I was too, to be honest. We had a good laugh. I thought you were a little more on top of things. My mistake.
You should give yourself up, Ms. Black.
Frank concentrated on measuring his words, on keeping the redness that wanted to overtake his mind at bay.
Or you should give this thing up, whatever it is. You should do that before anyone gets hurt.
Oh, we're pretty well past the getting hurt stage. Judge Silver, for instance, got a lot more than hurt. As did Dr. Flickinger, who actually wasn't such a bad fellow when his head was clear. We're in the mass extinction stage.
Frank choked the wheel of the cruiser.
What the fuck are you?
I could ask you the same question, but I know what you'd say.
I am the good father.
Because with you, it's all Nana, 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 isn't it? The protective daddy. Have you thought even once about all the other women and what you might be doing to them? What you might be putting at risk?
How do you know about my daughter?
It's my business to know. There's an old blues song that goes, "Before you accuse me, take a look at yourself." You need to widen your perspective, Frank.
What I need, Frank Geary thought, is my hands around your throat.
What do you want?
I want you to man up. I want you to man the fuck up and make this interesting. I want your precious Nana to be able to go to school and say, "My daddy isn't just a civil servant who catches feral cats, and he isn't just a guy who punches walls or pulls on my favorite shirt or yells at Mom when things aren't going his way. He's also the man who stopped that wicked old fairy who put all the women to sleep."
Leave my daughter out of it, you bitch.
The teasing note evaporated from her voice.
When you protected her at the hospital, that was brave. I admired it. I admired you. I truly did. I know you love her, and that's no small thing. I know, in your way, all you want is the best for her. And that makes me love you a tiny bit, even though you're part of the problem.
Ahead, the first 2 vehicles were pulling to a stop beside Reed Barrows's dented cruiser. Frank could see Barrows walking to meet them. Further on, he could see the bodies in the road.
"Stop this," said Frank. "Let them go. Let the women go. Not just my wife and daughter. All of them."
Evie said, "You'll have to kill me first."
8. Angel asked who was this Frank that Evie had been talking to.
"He's the Dragon Slayer," Evie said. "I just needed to make sure that he wasn't going to allow himself to be distracted by unicorns."
"You are so fucking crazy," Angel whistled.
Evie wasn't, but it wasn't an issue to debate with Angel, who, anyway, was entitled to her opinion. Chapter 9. 1. The fox comes to Lila in a dream. She knows it's a dream because the fox can talk. "Hey, babe," he says as he pads into the bedroom of the house on St. George Street she's now sharing with Tiffany, Janice Coates, and 2 of the docs from the Women's Center, Aaron Eisenberg and Jolie Surratt. Aaron and Jolie are unmarried. The 3rd Women's Center doctor, Georgia Pekins, lives on the other side of town, with 2 daughters who sorely miss their big brother. Another reason to know this is a dream is that she's alone in the room. The other twin bed, where Tiffany sleeps, is empty and neatly made up. The fox puts its cunning forepaws, white rather than red, as if he has walked through fresh paint to get here, on the quilt that covers her.
"What do you want?" Lila asks.
"To show you the way back," the fox says. "But only if you want to go." 2. When Lila opened her eyes, it was morning. Tiffany was in the other bed where she belonged, the blankets pushed down to her knees, her belly a half moon above the boxer shorts she slept in. She was over 7 months now. Instead of going to the kitchen to brew up a nasty-tasting mess of the chicory that served them as coffee in this version of dueling, Lila went straight down the hall and opened the front door to a pleasant spring morning. Time passed with such slippery limberness here. Watches kept ordinary time, but there was really nothing ordinary about it. The fox was there, as she'd known it would be, sitting on the weed-choked slate path with its brush of a tail curled neatly around its paws. It regarded Lila with bright interest. "Hey, babe," Lila said. The fox cocked its head and seemed to smile. Then it trotted down the path to the broken street and sat again, watching her, waiting. Lila went to wake Tiffany up. 3. In the end, 17 residents of our place followed the fox in 6 of the solar-powered golf carts, a caravan trundling slowly out of town and then along what had been Route 31 toward Balls Hill. Tiffany rode in the lead cart along with Janice and Lila, grousing the whole way about not being allowed to ride her horse. This had been nixed by Aaron and Jolie, who were concerned about the strength of Tiff's contractions when she still had 6 or 8 weeks to go. This much they had told the mom-to-be herself. What they hadn't passed on, although Lila and Janice knew, were their worries for the baby, which had been conceived while Tiffany was still using drugs on a daily, sometimes hourly, basis. Mary Pack, Magda Dubcek, the 4 members of the First Thursday Book Club, and 5 erstwhile dueling correctional inmates were going. Also along was Elaine Nutting, formerly Geary. She rode with the 2 lady docs. Her daughter had wanted to come, but Elaine had put her foot down and kept it down even when tears began to flow. Nana had been left with old Mrs. Ransom and her granddaughter. The 2 girls had become fast friends, but not even the prospect of spending a day with Molly had cheered Nana up. She wanted to follow the fox, she said, because it was like something out of a fairy tale. She wanted to draw it. "Stay with your little girl if you want," Lila had told Elaine. "We've got plenty of people." "What I want is to see what that thing wants," Elaine had replied, although in truth she didn't know if she did or not. The fox, now sitting in front of the slumped ruin of Pearson's barbershop and waiting patiently for the women to assemble and get moving, filled her with a sense of foreboding, unfocused but strong. "Come on," Tiffany called grumpily, "before I need to pee again." And so they followed the fox as it trotted out of town along the faded white line in the center of the highway, occasionally looking back to make sure his troop was still there, seeming to grin, seeming almost to say, "There sure are some fine-looking women in the audience today." It was an outing, a strange one, granted, but still a day off from their various chores and jobs, and there should have been talking and laughter, but the women in the trundling line of golf carts were almost silent. The headlamps of the carts came on when they were rolling, and as they went past the jungle that had once been Adam's lumberyard, the thought came to Lila that they looked more like a funeral cortege than gals on an outing. When the fox left the highway for an overgrown track a quarter mile past the lumberyard, Tiffany stiffened and put her hands protectively on her belly. "No, no, no. You can stop right here and let me out. I ain't going back to True Mayweather's trailer, not even if it ain't no more than a pile of scrap metal." "That's not where we're going," Lila said.
"How do you know?"
"Wait and see." As it turned out, the remains of the trailer were barely visible. A storm had knocked it off its blocks, and it lay on its side in high weeds and brambles like a rusty dinosaur. 30 or 40 yards from it, the fox cut left and slipped into the woods. The women in the 2 lead carts saw a ruddy orange flash of fur, then it vanished. Lila dismounted and went to where it had entered the woods. The ruins of the nearby shed had been entirely overgrown, but even after all this time, a sallow chemical smell remained. The meth may be gone, Lila thought, but the memories linger on. Even here, where time seems to gallop, pause for breath, then gallop again. Janice, Magda, and Blanche McIntyre joined her. Tiffany remained in the golf cart, holding her belly. She looked ill. "There's a game trail," Lila said, pointing. "We can follow it without much trouble."
"I'm not going in those woods, either," Tiffany said. "I don't care if that fox does a tap dance. I'm having goddamn contractions again."
"You wouldn't be going even if you weren't having them," Aaron said.
"I'll stay with you. Jolie, you can go if you want."
Jolie did. The 15 women went up the game trail in single file, Lila in the lead, and the former Mrs. Frank Geary bringing up the rear. They had been walking for almost 10 minutes when Lila stopped and raised her arms, index fingers pointing both left and right like a traffic cop who can't make up her mind.
"Holy shit," Celia Frode said. "I never seen nothing like that. Never."
The branches of the poplars, birches, and alders on either side were furred with moths. There seemed to be millions of them.
"What if they attack?"
Elaine murmured, keeping her voice low and thanking God that she hadn't given in to Nana's demands to be brought along. "They won't," Lila said.
"How can you know that?" Elaine demanded.
"I just do," Lila said. "They're like the fox." She hesitated, searching for the right word. "They're emissaries."
"For who?"
Blanche asked. "Or what?" This was another question Lila chose not to answer, although she could have. "Come on," she said. "Not far now." 4. 15 women stood in thigh-high grass, staring at what Lila had come to think of as the amazing tree. No one said anything for perhaps 30 seconds. Then, in a high, gasping voice, Jolie Surratt said,
"My good God in heaven."
The tree rose like a living pylon in the sun, its various knotted trunks weaving around each other, sometimes concentrating shafts of sunlight filled with dusty pollen, sometimes creating dark caves. Tropical birds disported among its many branches and gossiped in its ferny leaves. In front of it, the peacock Lila had seen before strutted back and forth like the world's most elegant doorman. The red snake was there too, hanging from a branch, a reptilian trapeze artist penduluming lazily back and forth. Below the snake was a dark crevasse where the various bowls seemed to draw back. Lila didn't remember this, but she wasn't surprised. Nor was she when the fox popped out of it like Jack from his box and took a playful snap at the peacock, who paid him no mind. Janice Coates took Lila's arm.
"Are we seeing this?"
"Yes," Lila said. Celia, Magda, and Jolie screamed shrilly in piercing three-part harmony. The white tiger was emerging from the split in the many-bowled trunk. It surveyed the women at the edge of the clearing with its green eyes, then stretched long and low, seeming almost to bow to them.
"Stand still," Lila shouted. "Stand still, all of you. It won't harm you,"
hoping with all her heart and soul that it was true. The tiger touched noses with the fox. It turned to the women again, seeming to fix on Lila with particular interest. Then it paced around the tree and out of sight.
"My God," Kitty McDavid said.
She was weeping.
"How beautiful was that? How fucking oh my God beautiful was that?"
Magda Dubček said,
"This is Svate Misto, holy place."
And she crossed herself. Janice was looking at Lila. "Tell me."
"I think," Lila said, "it's a way out. A way back. If we want it."
That was when the walkie-talkie on her belt came to life. There was a burst of static and no way to make out words. But it sounded like Aaron to Lila, and it sounded like she was yelling. 5. Tiffany was stretched across the front seat of the golf cart. An old St. Louis Rams t-shirt that she had scrounged somewhere lay crumpled on the ground. Her breasts, once little more than nubbins, jutted skyward in a plain D-cup cotton bra. The Lycra ones were now totally useless. Aaron was bent between her legs with her hands splayed on that amazing mound of belly. As the women came running, some brushing twigs and the odd moth from their hair, Aaron bore down. Tiffany shrieked,
"Stop that! Oh, for God's sake, stop!"
And her legs shot out in a V. "What are you doing?" Lila asked, reaching her. But when she looked down, what Aaron was doing and why she was doing it became obvious. Tiff's jeans were unzipped. There was a stain on the blue denim, and the cotton of Tiff's underpants was a damp pink. "The baby is coming, and its butt is where its head should be," Aaron said. "Oh my God, a breech," Kitty said. "I have to turn it around," Aaron said. "Get us back to town, Lila." "We'll have to straighten her up," Lila said. "I can't drive until you do that." With the help of Jolie and Blanche McIntyre, Lila got Tiffany to a half-sitting position with Aaron crammed in next to her. Tiffany screamed again.
"Oh, that hurts!"
Lila slid behind the wheel of the cart, her right shoulder tight against Tiffany's left one. Aaron had turned almost sideways to fit. "How fast will this thing go?" she asked. "I don't know, but we're going to find out." Lila hit the accelerator pedal, wincing at Tiff's howl of pain as the cart jerked forward. Tiffany screamed at every jounce, and there were a lot of jounces. At that moment, the amazing tree with its freight of exotic birds was the farthest thing from Lila Norcross's mind. This was not true of the former Elaine Geary. 6. They stopped at the Olympia Diner. Tiffany was in too much pain to go further. Aaron sent Janice and Magda back to town to get her bag, while Lila and three other women carried Tiffany inside.
"Pull a couple of the tables together," said Aaron,
"and do it fast. I need to straighten this baby out now, and I need Mom lying down to do it." Lila and Mary pushed over the tables. Margaret and Gail hefted Tiffany atop them, grimacing and turning their faces away, as if she were throwing mud at them instead of screams of objection. Aaron went back to work on Tiffany's stomach, kneading it like dough.
"I think it's starting to move, praise God. Come on, Junior, how about a little somersault for Dr. E?"
Aaron bore down on Tiff's stomach with one hand while Jolie Surratt pushed sideways.
"Stop!" Tiffany screamed. "Stop it, you fuckers!"
"It's turning," said Aaron, ignoring the profanity. "Really turning, thank God. Yank her pants off, Lila. Pants and underpants. Jolie, keep pressing. Don't let it turn back." Lila took one leg of Tiffany's jeans. Celia froed the other. They yanked and the old denims came off. Tiffany's underpants came with them partway, leaving brush strokes of blood and amniotic fluid on her thighs. Lila pulled them the rest of the way. They were heavy with liquid, warm and sopping. She felt her gorge rise, then settle back into place. The screams were constant now, Tiffany's head lashing from side to side.
"I can't wait for the bag," Aaron said. "This baby is coming right now. Only..."
She looked at her former office mate, who nodded.
"Somebody get Jolie a knife. A sharp one. We have to cut her a little." "I gotta push," Tiffany panted.
"The hell you do," Jolie said. "Not yet. The door's open, but we need to take the hinges off. Make a little more room." Lila found a steak knife, and in the bathroom, an ancient bottle of hydrogen peroxide. She doused the blade, stopped to consider the hand sanitizer by the door, and tried it. Nothing. The stuff inside had evaporated long ago. She hurried back. The women had surrounded Tiffany, Aaron, and Jolie in a semicircle. All were holding hands except for Elaine Geary, who had her arms wrapped tightly around her midsection. She was directing her gaze first to the counter, then to the empty booths, then out the door, anywhere but at the panting, screaming woman on the makeshift operating table, now mother naked, save for an old cotton bra. Jolie took the knife. Did you disinfect it with something? That'll do, Aaron said. Mary, find me a styrofoam cooler, if there's one around. One of you other ladies get towels. There'll be some in the kitchen. Put them on top of the... A miserable howl from Tiffany as Jolie Surratt performed a steak knife episiotomy, sans anesthetic. Put the towels on top of the golf carts, Aaron finished.
Oh, yeah, the solar panels. That was Kitty. To heat them up. Hey, that's pretty smart.
We want them warm but not hot, Aaron said. I have no intention of roasting our newest citizen. Go on. Elaine stood where she was, letting the other women wash around her like water around a rock, continuing to direct her gaze at any object that was not Tiffany Jones. Her eyes were shiny and shallow. How close is she? Lila asked.
7 centimeters, Jolie said. She'll be at 10 before you can say Jack Robinson. Cervical effacement is complete. One thing that went right, at least. Push, Tiffany. Save a little for next time, though.
Tiffany pushed. Tiffany screamed. Tiffany's vagina flexed, then closed, then opened again. Fresh blood flowed between her legs.
I don't like the blood.
Lila heard Aaron mutter this to Jolie from the side of her mouth, like a racetrack tout passing on a hot tip. There's way too much. Christ, I wish I at least had my fetoscope. Mary came back with the sort of hard plastic cooler Lila had toted to Maylock Lake many times when she and Clint and Jared used to go on picnics there. Printed on the side was Budweiser, the king of beers.
Will this do, Dr. E?
Fine, Aaron said, but didn't look up. Okay, Tiff, big push.
My back is killing me,
Tiffany said. But me became me as her face contorted and her fists beat up and down on the chipped formica of the tabletop.
I see its head, Lila shouted. I see its face. Oh, Christ, Aaron, what?
Aaron pushed Jolie aside and seized one of the baby's shoulders before it could retreat, her fingertips pressing deep in a way that made Lila feel ill. The baby's head slid forward, tilted strenuously to one side, as if it was trying to look back to where it had come from. The eyes were shut, the face ashy gray. Looped around the neck and up one cheek toward the ear, like a hangman's noose, was a blood-spotted umbilical cord that made Lila think of the red snake hanging from the amazing tree. From the chest down, the infant was still inside its mother, but one arm had slithered free and hung down limply. Lila could see each perfect finger, each perfect nail. Quit pushing, Aaron said. I know you want to finish it, but don't push yet.
I need to,
Tiffany rasped.
You'll strangle your baby if you do,
Jolie said. She was back beside Aaron, shoulder to shoulder.
Wait, just give me a second.
Too late, thought Lila. It's already strangled. You only have to look at that gray face. Jolie worked one finger beneath the umbilical cord, then two. She flexed the fingers in a come-on gesture, first pulling the cord away from the infant's neck, and then slipping it off. Tiffany screamed, every tendon in her neck standing out in stark relief.
Push, Aaron said, just as hard as you can. On three.
Jolie, don't let it faceplant on this filthy fucking floor when it comes.
Tiff. One, two, three.
Tiffany pushed. The baby seemed to shoot into Jolie Surratt's hands. It was slimy, it was beautiful, and it was dead.
Straw, Jolie shouted. Get a straw, now!
Elaine stepped forward. Lila hadn't seen her move. She already had one ready, the paper stripped off.
Here,
Aaron took the straw. Lila, Aaron said, open his mouth. His. Until then, Lila hadn't noticed the tiny gray comma below the baby's stomach. Open his mouth, Aaron repeated. Carefully, Lila used two fingers to do as she was told. Aaron put one end of the straw in her own mouth and the other in the tiny opening Lila's fingers had created. Now push up on his chin, Jolie instructed. Gotta create suction.
What point? Dead was dead.